Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. MacDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. MacDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, The John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies, if only he'd used them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry and an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Beth Ruggiero York on the show with me. She's got a fantastic new memoir. It's called Flying Alone. And what a great story. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thanks, Hank. I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Beth, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Okay. It's interesting because I remember it very vividly. And I was probably about 11 years old. And I remember standing at my bedroom window and thinking, I have three goals for my life. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to learn the Arabic language. And I'm going to restore a house. So writing a book was then and there and never left me.
Wow. Well, those are three audacious goals. And writing a book, I can, I've talked to enough people. I can see how that seeps into an 11-year-old's mind. Remodeling a house. Okay. I get that.
Well, I look at that now and I think, what were you thinking?
Well, it seems so glamorous when you're not paying for it.
Right.
where did Arabic come from?
I was always fascinated with languages growing up, and I Arabic to me, I loved the way it sounded. And I loved the way it looked in the written language. Ultimately, I did not have the opportunity to study Arabic, but instead I studied Chinese, and that's been my another passion in my life.
Wow. Were you a bookish kid?
Probably, yeah.
Do you remember if there was a book or a series or an author that made you feel like you wanted to write a book one day?
Well, I don't know if there was one that made me feel that way, but I remember being, and this was when I was 10 years old, 11 years old, being completely enamored with the Nancy Drew series of books and read every last one of them. But that, other than that, no, I didn't. There wasn't somebody whose writing made me specifically want to write a book.
It was just one of those ingrained things that just, it just made sense above everything else.
It just did. Yeah.
Did you ever tell anyone about this dream? Did you ever share that with anyone?
Probably not. No, I didn't. I kept it to myself. And, what happened after that, a couple of years later, my father died. And really the first writing I was doing was, yes, right after he died, I started writing a letter to him every night. And it's a huge notebook filled with these letters. And although I never thought of it in terms of a book, it was just my way of dealing with it. But that was where the writing really started.
Wow. Do you still have that notebook?
Oh, I do.
I bet that's powerful to look back on and revisit that time.
I haven't really done it in depth ever. I have it. I know exactly where it is, but I need to sit down, and that's one of my upcoming projects, to sit down and read that. Sure, it'll shed a lot of light on things.
I'm sure it will. You had a couple of years after that 11-year-old, declared the things that she was going to accomplish in the world, you had your first experience with an airplane, didn't you?
I did indeed, yes. It was when I was 13, shortly after my father died. It was the first time, it's not the first time I flew, but the first time I flew alone. And my mother sent me out to spend time with my aunt and uncle and cousins in Colorado from New York. And that one flight, it was from JFK to Denver. And that, I remember sitting in the seat when the airplane was taking off and thinking, oh my gosh, this is something I must do.
That's, how was it different for you flying alone as opposed to with family? This was your first time flying alone, but this was when you sort of had the epiphany. What was it about flying alone do you think that triggered that?
It was the freedom, and I've always been very independent. And when I was with my mother or with family or parents and my brother and such, everything was very orderly and operated very in a very disciplined way. But when I was alone, I always felt this incredible surge of freedom and excitement. And I think that's what allowed me to truly take in what the flying was all about.
So, did this become one of those things that that you started pursuing? How much of a personal awakening was this for you?
Well, it was something that I put with those other three dreams that I told you about and put into my file in my head as future goals. I put it aside, and but it was there just as the other ones were, and I would end up going back to it just as I went to back to almost every, well, actually every one of the goals I set.
So, how did you, when you were obviously old enough, how did you start pursuing that dream?
Well, it was, and this I tell about this in the book. It was I had studied Chinese in East Asian Studies in college. And loved it, studied abroad. But that was back in the early 80s, and the prospects of a job at that time were slim to none using what I loved, the Chinese language. And so I remember shortly after graduating, sitting on the beach one day, and a little plane flew over, and it reminded me of that dream. I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And that's where it started.
So, do you go to the local airport and start looking for lessons? Like how does one begin to, chase that career?
I went to literally, that's exactly what I did. I went to the local airport. In this case, it was Beverly Airport in Massachusetts on the North Shore, and got the information and started taking lessons. And at the same time, I don't remember how this came into it, but I knew I wanted to do it in the military. And so I started taking lessons with the full intention that I was going to go. I wanted naval flight training because that was the best of the best. Now, this is before Top Gun ever came out, so I didn't get it from that movie. So yeah, I wanted to go into the Navy. I did not. They did not accept me. I had passed everything and was ready to go for flight training, except there was this one little glitch in my medical history, and that's what hung me up with the Navy.
Now,
Go
speaking of
ahead.
medical histories, you were sidelined with a medical diagnosis, weren't you?
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah,
Yes.
tell us about how that came about and what was it like getting that news?
Well, the news came out right after I graduated from college. I knew I wanted to go to China. This is before the flying came back into my head, and to the mainland of China. I'd studied in Taiwan, so I went to China. I got a job taking tour groups very early on in the China tourism time. And I took my first tour group to China, and we got there at about that same time. I started to have pain in one of my eyes, and then with each day I lost more vision. It was frightening. And I went to doctors over there one after another. Nobody knew what it was. At any rate, when I came back to the States, I got the diagnosis of what they called probable multiple sclerosis. And that was on my record. And back then, of course, nothing was computerized. I could have lied about that and said no and not told them about it. But under pressure from family members, I did, and for that reason, the Navy said, "No, we can't take. You're too much of a liability."
What did that do for the hopes that you had built up for this?
I said I was very disappointed, but at the same time, I said, "Well, I'm taking lessons, and I'm just going to do it through the civil aviation path," and that's what I did.
Wow. And how long did it take for you to, get your license and certification and all that stuff?
Oh, it was a fun process, an interesting process, and that's a lot of what my book, Flying Alone, gets into. But it took, I went into it full time at that point. I said, okay, I'm going to just dive into this. And that's what I did. To earn money, I started as the line person at the flight school where I was taking lessons. And as a line person, that means you're driving the fuel truck around the airport, filling airplanes and doing all kinds of grunt jobs like that. At any rate, though, I was just lessons, 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 got my private, went straight to my instrument, my commercial, and multi-engine, all of the ratings.
You really give us insight and a look into this industry that so many of us entrust our lives to. We buy a ticket, we get on the airplane, we go to our destination, and we really don't want to think about anything behind the scenes. And you give us some of those glimpses behind the scenes. What was when you started putting this book together and kind of going through all the memories and things like that, how did you choose what interesting things to tell us?
Well, yeah, I started writing right after I stopped flying. I stopped flying because I lost my FAA medical certificate because they gave me a definitive diagnosis of MS at that point. This is in the early this is in 1990, and so I wrote it at that time. It was all very fresh, and I knew I had to write it down because there were so many crazy, remarkable things that went on those years, and so I started writing it as a book. I chose the incidents based on, and because there were many more, I chose the incidents based on their worth in a book, following a story and creating a flow, that not just anecdotal stuff. And so they had to weave into the story. That's how I chose them. Obviously, there were also some that just were too mind-boggling not to include, and I included those. But I'm glad I did because, here we are 30 years later, and some of the things I read when I revisited the book after all these years, I said, "Oh my gosh, I don't remember that." And so it was quite a journey.
Not only do you talk about, the pursuit of your career dreams, but there's also your personal experiences and interpersonal experiences. Tell us a little bit about, that time and, including that into the story. And is it, when you're writing a memoir, are you ever is there ever a point when you're like, I don't know how much of this to tell, and how do you get over that fear of exposing yourself?
Gosh, that was something that I thought about then. And when I revisited just these past couple of years before publishing it, I thought about very long and hard about certain things that had gone on at that time, and was I willing to bare my soul? And I remember reading something about writing that said that, or from writing memoirs, I should say, that it's okay to show yourself as being vulnerable. Don't just always be the winner and the one who is victorious, etc. And that hit home with me, and I said, okay, I'm going to show people what I was really going through at that time. And interpersonally, that was my flight instructor, my very first flight instructor, probably, yeah, my only flight instructor, was became we had a relationship. And as my boyfriend, it was a very toxic relationship. And the whole book is intertwined, the flying, because the flying and the relationship, because they were completely connected. And we flew, you know, he and I flew for together for 3 years, 4 years before it all ended.
Wow. You stopped flying, did you say, in 1990?
Yes.
And you started gathering all of your thoughts for the book then. It's 2019 now. What have you been doing in the interim?
Well, I put it aside at that point, and I knew I'd go back to it, and I did just recently. But I knew I'd know when the right time came. In the meantime, though, after that, and I was dealing with a full-blown diagnosis of multiple sclerosis and ramifications of that. So first few years were rather, were adjusting and also dealing with my health situation. After, as the years went by in the 90s, I went back to get my master's degree in East Asian Studies at Harvard. And that set the path for me for the next 20 years. And I graduated from there in 97. My advisor at Harvard said, if you don't want to get a PhD, which I did not, he said, try getting into translation. And I took his advice, and I have been translating ever since then. At that time, there wasn't a whole lot of work, but now the supply of translators for that language is so far short of the demand.
So what brought the idea for this book back up?
Oh, it was always in my head. It was always there. I just didn't know when the time would come. Then a few years ago, my husband, who we've just been married 7 years, but he kept encouraging me to bring it out and start and get it moving. And I did.
So when he encourages you and you kind of realize that now's the time, how do you begin to put it all together and to get it into publishing shape?
Well, I had a lot to learn, a whole lot.
Yeah.
But first of all, because I had written it back in the early 90s and I did research publishing at that time, which was totally different world than it is now. But some of the basics were still there. And I pulled out the manuscript, which was in a big box, and I started in paper, obviously, and started going through it and editing it and seeing what I wanted to keep, what I wanted to change, what I wanted to add. But then I knew I needed to get professional editing assistance. And so I hired a developmental editor and a copy editor after that. And I worked with the developmental editor very closely and really got it to a point where I felt good about it.
Did you lay out a timeline of events, and how do you choose where the story begins and where the story ends? You know, memoir is usually a look at a certain window of time. How do you encapsulate that to know this is going to be the story I'm telling?
Well, it was, it started at the beginning of the flying time and ended actually not at the end of the time I flew in 1990, but actually it ends, the original manuscript just ended where, my flight instructor, Steve, and I broke up, and that was a big turning point in my emotional life. So when I went back to it, though, I knew that, and then these were the hardest things for me to get to where I knew they were okay or readable, was the beginning and the end, and where to start, where to end. And So I started with a look back at that original first flight that I had told you about when I was alone, and ended where I had started. But then, I mean, where I had the original manuscript had ended, but then added some interesting things about getting to the airlines. And then finally, what happened to all those people that I'd encountered and flown with and become friends with over the years?
This is not the first book that you've written, though, is it?
No, far different than what I've written before, though.
You also write fiction, right?
No,
No?
actually, nonfiction. I, as of starting 10 years ago, I found another passion to add to my life, and that was photography. And I have become a professional photographer. I teach photography. I take people on workshops to places all over the world. And night photography has always been a passion of mine and during this photography time. And I wrote a book called Fun in the Dark, A Guide to Successful Night Photography. And that's been a very popular book for photographers. I also co-wrote a book about the Everglades National Park photographic destination, and it's a guide to photographing in Everglades.
Nice. And I meant to say nonfiction. I didn't
Oh,
mean
okay.
to. Your work as a photographer, that really intrigues me. I love when people pursue multiple artistic expressions. Do you see an overlap between your photography work and your writing? And by that I mean, do you think that being a visual artist like that helps you to paint a word picture for people that maybe because there are details that we notice, in photography that those things trigger, certain ways to convey things in words. And that's so clunky the way I'm
No,
trying to say it, but
I completely understand what you're
yeah.
saying. Yes, it's absolutely so. The when you look at things as a photographer and you're composing a scene and you're looking for different elements, you become definitely more observant and more aware. And yes, you are able to, and it does. I think it helps. It supplements for my writing so that I can describe scenes, or situations or even people and their characteristics, in a better way.
When you started getting the book together, Flying Alone, and you had the story and you had really kind of nailed it down, after hiring that developmental editor, who kind of helped you see the lay of the land, for lack of a better term, what did you do with the book then? How did you start getting it out to the world?
Well, at that point, I was going through with this. The big decision was, do I publish traditionally? Do I pursue finding an agent, or do I publish it on my own? And my thought or my vision had always been to publish traditionally, but I took a very hard look at what's going on in that industry now. And self-publishing, weighed the advantages and disadvantages, and realized that I wanted to self-publish because I wanted to maintain control over the book. I wanted to mean, I wanted to decide the cover. I didn't want anyone to tell me, change this or do that. And from what I understand, is that in traditional publishing, if you get a contract and you get an advance, they don't market it for you the way they used to. So you're, especially if you're a new author, and basically if you get an advance, plan on spending that on marketing the book. So I decided to do it my way.
Which is, that's the great thing about the time we live in, is the power is back in the author's hands. And
Absolutely.
yeah, phenomenal. The book is called Flying Alone. Beth, when people get the book and when they get to the end and they close that back cover, what do you hope they're left with when their time with you is over?
I hope that they are left with an exciting experience having read the book, and also a little behind the scenes, but not just flying behind the scenes of a woman in an industry that it was not. There really weren't many women at all at that time in the 80s, and so there's that aspect of it. But there's also the relationship and emotional duress and handling getting out of a situation that is bad for you. So in many ways, there's a lot of woman, females in situations. But on the other hand, the other person that I'm appealing to are the pilots, and the student pilots in particular.
Yeah.
Kind of, this is what you shouldn't do when you're learning to fly. Things to be aware of. And that is kind of the response I'm getting.
Yeah, and this book is definitely not just a chick lit book. This has wide appeal. I found myself laughing, cringing, turning the pages, going, "What is she going to get into next?" You know, it's such a fun read. Beth, if someone out there is listening and they think they might have a story to tell, and they think that their life might be interesting for people to read, what piece of advice would you give them to maybe get started pursuing a memoir of their own?
That's a great question. I would tell them to start writing the experiences, but first define a time period of your life. You're not writing an autobiography where it starts from the day you were born, perhaps, and ends now. A memoir is an excerpt of your life that was a particularly interesting time, difficult time, whatever it was. So define the timeline and then just start writing, not necessarily in formal paragraphs, but writing down everything you want to include in that. And then as you go along with that process, your mind will start thinking about how it will fit in with the big story. So when you're ready to actually start putting it together as a memoir, you have a destination in mind, and you also have what will know how to weave it or have the information to weave it into a story. Because I think a lot of memoirs sometimes are just recounting events, but what compels people to go from page one to the last page is a story. So there needs to be a story involved in that.
Wonderfully said. Beth, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. The book is Flying Alone. There's a link to it in the show notes. If you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, the book's in Kindle Unlimited. Also, Beth, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Hank. This was fun.
Also, before we go, can you tell people where they can find you online if they want to connect with you and dig into all that you do?
Absolutely. I'm on all of the social media. You can find me. My website is www.BethRuggieroYork, just like it's written on the cover of the book, .com. And through that website, you can find my blog. You can find links to purchase the book. And you can also find a link to my photography website, which is BethRuggiero.com. And that where I display my photography, sell my photography, and also tell people about the workshops that I'll be teaching in the next year.
Great. We're going to send them all to see you. Thanks for coming on the show, Beth.
Thank you, Hank.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the Great Curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690...
1692. They burned her alive in the Salem Common. The only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just, I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay to kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right. Never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the great curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the great curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the great curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.